think that it's very problematic moving forward. This is the kind of stuff we see where you end up with concentration camp regimes.
Andrea Pitzer, you mentioned Fred Korematsu, who is the Japanese-American, challenging the detention of Japanese-Americans in World War II, over 110,000 Japanese-Americans in this country. Later, the government would apologize. Well, last month, federal judge Dana Sabra in San Diego ruled all children under the age of 5 must be reunited with their parents within 14 days. Tuesday's the deadline for that. And all children above 5 must be reunited with their parents within 30 days. So the government has 2 more weeks for that. We're talking about over 2,000 children. Now, interestingly, in an interview with the North County Times in 2003, and this is out of the San Diego Tribune, Judge Dana Sabra said his experience as a Japanese American shaped him. He said, quote, "In light of that experience, I was raised with a great awareness of prejudice, no doubt. There were times when I was growing up that I felt different and hurtful things occurred because of my race." Judge Dana Sabra is a Japanese American. His mother was Japanese. Andrea, talk about the detention of Japanese Americans in this country.
Well, I think it's a story that people think they know, but they don't actually know, and it's really relevant today. You know, there's between 110 and 120,000 Japanese and Japanese-American people who were detained after Pearl Harbor. And a lot of people think that it was done out of sort of this fear reaction to this horrific attack. But in reality, there was a government analysis by one of their top intelligence people at the time that very intelligently analyzed that it would be useless to detain this group, that it was already known at about 300 people or so that were actually dangerous, they could be rounded up, that it might do much, much more harm and create a kind of backlash to actually detain these citizens. This was all known. And this, and in fact, Hoover, who does not exactly have a great civil rights record, J. Edgar Hoover, at the time and World War II, did not think that mass detention was the answer. So there were many people in the White House, in the administration, in the military, who knew that this was a useless thing. It became part of a political objective. It got swept up in just the kind of rhetoric that we're seeing today, where people got political advantage and power from damaging and doing great harm to a vulnerable minority in the country. And what's interesting is that this information, these intelligence reports, were actually concealed by the U.S. Solicitor General. When that Korematsu case went before the Supreme Court, that information was suppressed and it was not introduced. And I think that anyone who looks at this administration today and thinks that it would be more likely to turn over that kind of information in these kinds of court debates, you know, I'd be very skeptical that they would be even more forthcoming today. And so whether the justices would even get the full picture of what's going on if something similar were to come back, I think, is a real question as well.
Well, Andrea, do you think that the term concentration camp is appropriate in this context? Because most people's association with that term is, in fact, with extermination camps like Auschwitz and Treblinka during the Second World War?
I think that we need to sort of recapture this word concentration camp. It should be that Auschwitz is the first thing that people think of, Auschwitz and the death camps, when they hear the term, because it's the most horrific industrialized version. I mean, it created this genocide that killed millions. So it should be the first thing we think of. But people forget that Auschwitz, before it was a death camp, was also just another camp that was part of the regular Konzentrationslager system in Germany. And that system existed for several years before it evolved and changed and grew into a horrific killing machine. And there were also almost 4 decades of concentration camps, things that were called concentration camps, civilian detention on the basis of identity, that happened before that. And so we need to keep in mind, how do you get from regular democracy and regular life into something like the death camps? And the truth is, it takes several years of propaganda, of manipulation of the public, of bending the courts, of weakening legislatures. And so it's those warning signs and those preemptive things we should be thinking about, rather than just that Auschwitz becomes then some island of isolation that came out of nowhere, because that's not how it happened. I think we need to reclaim this term concentration camp for this kind of irregular detention of civilians without trial.
Andrea Pitzer, we want to thank you so much for being with us, journalist and author of One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps. We'll link to your piece, History Lesson, Gitmo Started as a Detention Camp for Immigrants, and Why the Tent City for Children is a Concentration Camp.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host the class Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future at Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, July 7th and 4 p.m. at KBOO in Portland. This class will explore hip hop history locally and nationally, KBOO hip hop programming, how hip hop influences art, culture, and political consciousness, rhyme, writing, and production, and how liberation struggles have contributed to hip-hop culture. Again, that's Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future at Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, July 7th at 4 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba during slavery and Jim Crow with Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The head of a U.S. congressional delegation visiting Russia said today he hopes for a new day in repairing relations between Russia and the United States. Senator Richard
Welcome to Sojourner Truth exclusively on Pacifica Radio and its affiliate networks. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Whatever happened to the Occupy movement? On September 17, 2011, activists converged on Wall Street to rally against corporate greed, austerity, and economic disparity. Then they did something unexpected. They stayed. Today, a one-hour special with Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky, author of The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. Michael Gould-Wartofsky, an occupier himself, was also one of the first social scientists to document the Occupy movement, from its beginnings in Zuccotti Park to its spread from New York City to cities across the nation and across the world, and to the evictions that forced occupiers to evolve and redefine their place in society. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. We go now to our interview with Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky, author of the new book, The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. Michael Gould-Wartofsky is a PhD candidate in sociology at NYU, New York University, and holds a degree in government from Harvard University. His writings have appeared in publications including The Nation magazine, Mother Jones, and Salon. His book is the product of a year on the ground, participating in the Occupy movement in New York City, and later researching Occupy's roots and legacy, interviewing fellow occupiers in cities across the United States. Our guest of the book, The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement, I'd like to welcome Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky. Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I actually wanted to start this discussion talking a little bit about you, because a lot has been written and said about the quote-unquote millennial generation, the challenges facing the millennial generation. And I'd like to know why a Harvard-educated young man like you would be interested in Occupy and the kind of politics that Occupy represented and to some degree tried to resist. Tell us a little bit about the early influences.
So I'm the grandson of immigrant sweatshop workers, actually, and, you know, was the first person in my family to go to Harvard. I am also the son of a father who was born into poverty in Brownsville, Brooklyn.
Ocean Hill, Brownsville,
yeah.
My first teaching job.
Is that right?
PS 55 in
wow.
Ocean Hill, Brownsville,
wow.
Brooklyn.
That was an epic struggle in Brownsville.
Oh, yeah, I was part of that.
So I was kind of brought up in... you know, surrounded by the everyday reality of inequality in New York City, but also kind of steeped in the radical tradition that I kind of, you know, inherited from my my father and mother. My father passed away when I was a kid, and my mother raised me up as a kind of single mother, and, you know, she was just a radical educator and brilliant political thinker in her own right, and I learned a lot from both of them. And then in my own political evolution, I was part of the high school student movement in New York City in a time when we were seeing the first really radical budget cuts from the
so
Bloomberg.
So that movement was opposing Bloomberg's cuts?
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. This was the first anti-austerity movement that we'd seen in some time in New York City. We allied with teachers and CUNY students and working
City
families.
City University of New
City
York.
City University of mm-hmm. New York. That's right. And... you know, had walkouts and strikes, and it was part of my political education. It wasn't just in the classroom, you know, it was in the streets kind of from the first.
Was it a multiracial movement?
It was a multiracial movement, and that's, mm-hmm. I think that was the criterion for every other movement that I was a part of after that, and those that, you know, I was also part of the anti-war movement, which was also multiracial, and that's something that's been written out of the history mm-hmm. of that movement, and the labor movement as well as I entered college. I was part of the student labor action movement at Harvard that really confronted directly the huge wealth gap that we saw even within our own campus and within our own community there. And I graduated, of course, into the Great Recession. I think this was an experience that really shaped my life and the lives of many in my generation, and that has really been part of this progression from that we've seen from Generation X to I guess what I would call Generation Left, you know, because we saw in this crisis the equation between, you know, the future just wasn't computing for us.
So what lessons did you glean coming out of that high school movement? I spent some time in CUNY, City University of New York. I was at Queens College as part of the SEEK program. I don't know if it's still around, a program for inner city youth, mm-hmm. Kind of quote-unquote mainstreaming, helping to mainstream them into being competitive in a four-year university.
Right.
And that came out of the whole welfare rights movement, et cetera, the open admissions for City University of New York that prior to that was pretty white, right? So I could then see that extension with the fight within City University and high school students. So what kinds of skills specifically did you glean, and then you were able to adapt when you were at Harvard and then in your work after Harvard with places like Occupy?
So in terms of the skills, I think, you know, the first one, I think, is one of meeting people where they are and, you know, being able to really understand the conditions, the material conditions that people are facing. And I think, you know, as a public high school student, it was easy to see public policy translating into real life outcomes, you know, for, I mean, I was in an underfunded school, but there were, of course, many more underfunded schools than that. and being able to work kind of citywide with people in the public schools who are facing the impact of these budget cuts and who are, you know, in some cases facing firsthand the impact of the war in Iraq and the invasion. I think that was really a transformative experience for me. And then when I came to Harvard, I think, you know, really being able to on the flip side of it, confront those in power who are responsible for you know, a lot of these inequalities and imbalances. And of course, there's a structural basis for them, but you're able to really put a face on them, name on them. I was there during the administration of Larry Summers, who was eventually overthrown by an alliance of faculty and students. That taught me some valuable skills as well.
And was in terms part of the Obama administration.
That's right. That's right. We we didn't mean to send him to the White House, but we were able to really organize in a way that, you know, and this was something I learned from working people, you know, organize in a way that spoke to the real concerns and the real struggles that people were facing every day, from you know, the lack of a living wage, which persisted, to, you know, the struggle for health care and for union rights. Most recently, you know, I'm now a graduate student at New York University, and those skills have translated into this unionization campaign that we won in a recent contract campaign that we won.
Yeah.
And being able to really talk about raising the floor and really raising, breaking through the wage ceiling that, you know, had been imposed by the administration on some really, you know, poorly paid workers there.
Let me ask you this, though, because a lot of generation younger than you right now, trying to get themselves together in Ferguson, Missouri, and parts of New York City, the Black Lives Matter movement, et cetera, really grappling with the day-to-day work that it takes to build a movement and or to do that kind of work, even if you don't want to call it a movement,
right,
or even a political moment. I'd like you to just say a little bit about the kind of behind-the-scenes work that it took, even in that struggle in high school and throughout. Because people, you see a protest on the street, you see right, the banners, you know, et cetera. You see people talking in front of the microphone. But what is the behind-the-scenes work and the skill that is involved to make that happen? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The unglamorous side of movements and protests,
right,
but necessary.
Of course, of course. And you know, that work, I think, takes many forms and is really varies from movement to movement, what it takes to build that. I think, you know, in Ferguson, they were facing greater constraints and greater challenges than, you know, people like me face in New York City or at Harvard. And of course, you know,
that right.
Yeah. So the work is going to be, it's going to be a lot more uphill battle there. But what I've seen in my interviews, and I, you know, I think one of the things I tried to do in the book was really kind of reach beyond my own experience and to bring those voices into conversation from different movements. And I think that the work that it takes is really about organizing for power and giving people a sense that things are possible. That they were told weren't possible. Empowering people in ways and allowing for people self-empowerment and self-organization, giving people tools and training and that kind of thing to be able to organize themselves and to be able to organize in their own communities. And
by
I think,
tools and training, though, I'm trying to get down to the practicalities
right,
here.
Right.
You know, because it doesn't get talked about a lot.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, not that I don't know some of it myself. I do, having done activism for quite a long time. But
right,
somebody has got to do the flyer.
That's right.
Somebody has got to run out and get the copies made.
Right.
Somebody has got to have the skill to be able to write a press release.
That's right.
Then you need people to follow up afterwards and make sure you make the phone calls,
yep,
to make sure that the press release has gone out to the major. You know what I mean?
That's right.
It's that kind of day-to-day stuff. You're calling a meeting.
Right.
Some people have forgotten about the meeting. You got to try. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
It's all of what it takes in that sort of day-to-day.
Absolutely.
Work.
And I think, I mean, you just really covered quite a bit of ground there. I think there's also the sort of question of how you interact with other people, you know, from a multiplicity of backgrounds, you know, in a movement like Occupy, you know, in a movement like the 99% movement, that was imperative to really be able to when you call a meeting, to be able to allow people to speak and not to, you know, drown people out, not to have the people with the loudest voices in the room or you know,
the power relations.
Exactly.
In the room.
To be really attentive to the power relations and to be able to bring people you know, together in a way that doesn't reproduce the structural inequalities and the power relations of our society in the spaces of the movement. And I would add to your very thorough list there that kind of challenge too.
That was a mini list.
Yes. But you know, that's one of the practical challenges as well, because people are coming from all kinds of places, and you know, it's you don't leave that power at the door when you or you know, at the park when you're occupying or organizing. It's there, and you have to confront it.
Yeah, and again, our guest is Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky. He is the author of a brand new book, fascinating book, The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we're having a conversation about organizing, about Michael's background, and just about the experience of the millennials. I mean, there is, or at least there was, and to some degree still is, an image of the millennials or younger being apathetic, of not really being involved. I think Occupy did help to bust through some of that, and certainly now the Black Lives Matter movement, which is a multiracial movement, has also busted through some of that. But specifically on your book, why did you do the book? How did you, you know what I mean? What got into you?
That's a good question, the why question. I saw it as a chance to really bring some voices to the page, as well as my own, but, you know, in my own critical analysis, but to bring some voices to the page that hadn't been heard, some people who hadn't been seen, some movements that really hadn't been, you know, covered in the mainstream coverage. I know your show was an exception, but in the mainstream coverage of the movement, there was...
Well, we're not mainstream.
That's right. That's right. And, yeah. You know, and I think having been there from day one, I saw the transformation of the movement from one that was much more, kind of looked a lot more like the people I went to Harvard with, some of the people I went to Harvard with are, you know, more like the monolithic or monoracial kind of campaigns that we'd seen among some privileged spaces.
Kind of well-educated.
Exactly.
Having the ability to write clearly, you do. Okay.
Thank you. But
yeah.
But the transformation of that space into one that was open to you know, working class people, poor people, communities of color, and not just open to them, but shaped by them, and really fundamentally about them and their lives. And I think between Occupy Wall Street and the Black Lives Matter movement, you really are seeing, I think, the first stirrings of a tectonic shift in our political alignments. I think this generation is one, I found, that rejects the raw deal that we inherited from, you know, the Reagan, Clinton, Bush era. Mm-hmm. And is seeking a different kind of politics, you know, one that's not a top-down politics, seeking a different kind of political economy, one that's not premised on trickle-down economics. In this country, I think we're seeing the beginnings of something. You know, there was a saying in Occupy, this is the beginning of the beginning. Of course, as I show in the book, that wasn't true of the movement. There was a real prehistory, and uh-huh. You know, there was Tahrir Square, there was the Indignado movement, there was, you know, a lot of movements that in New York City that really went into the making of this movement. But I do think that this is the beginning of a fundamental shift in the political kind of direction of my generation, at least, and the degree to which we are able to find a path to power for ourselves and for others who are affected by this crisis and by, you know, this most unequal recovery in living memory that we're living through right now, I think is the degree to which we're going to see change in the coming years.
Right. So how did you, because Occupy, you know, very difficult in a lot of ways to define. It was a very, very wide movement. I have a list in front of me that we put together on just actually October of 2011. And, you know, you could see the already, you know, what had begun in other places, and of course it got a lot wider. Do you recall the figures at its height? How many cities were involved? How many countries?
Yes, there were just in October 2011, on one day, October 15th, there were 952 Occupy protests and occupations on that day. And that was
internationally,
mm-hmm. right? So you saw a map, and there were just kind of Occupy springing up country after country, and not just in the places you would expect as well. There was, I think, on every single continent, including some scientists in Antarctica. it was actually everywhere.
Scientists in Antarctica?
That's right. You know, I think that really speaks to the international dimensions of this struggle, and you know, the power of capital is international. And I think in the fall of 2011, you really saw the degree to which our power can be internationalized, our power can be global as well, and the power of people organizing together and occupying together. And that was, of course, you know, ended prematurely and foreclosed very quickly, but, you know, I think that's in part because of how powerful it was.
What do you think captured people's imagination? I mean, that is quite quick, swiftly, 952 actions in a single day across the world.
Right.
I mean, you were there from the beginning. I don't know if you went in with the intention of doing the book. You went in as part of as an occupier yourself.
Right.
What is it about Occupy that you think really sparked that? People were really excited about it. And I remember the early days of Occupy LA, of just people standing around a city hall and holding up signs. And I can tell you, people who were walking by, people who were driving by, their faces just looked different. It was just a level of an interaction, of a communication, of a power that we had not seen in that way in quite some time.
Absolutely. And I think part of what sparked the imagination of millions was this represented the return of the repressed, you know, to take a page from Fanon. The return of class politics, you know, after the end of history.
So you're reading Fanon.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, excellent.
And the return of anti-racist politics, mm-hmm. in the so-called post-racial era. It was the return of the repressed to American politics and to international politics. And there was just kind of this is finally, you know, something we can talk about in public. This is something we can act on in public. There's a sense of possibility that wasn't there before. And part of it was just the demonstration effect. And that didn't just come from Occupy Wall Street or Zuccotti Park, of course. That came from the Arab Spring. It came from all around the world. So that was, I think, the moment that...
What about the 99%? Where did that come? Because that really got to people. Because even people who were not part of the protest, they would walk by and they'd see a sign, "We're the 99%. And people were like... They got it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Everybody got it. It was a language that everybody could understand.
Yeah.
That spoke to people and spoke to also the lack of democracy, right? Because, you know, 99-1, that's a fundamental kind of dictatorship in the sense of capital, right? Where you have people without the resources, without you know, who've been denied access to the things they need, and also to political power, kind of seeing that they can take back a little bit of that in their everyday lives. And the 99% has a different origin story. I tell a different origin story in the book than the one that has been propagated, I think, in many other narratives in the media and in academia. You know, there's a claim that it was invented by some anarchist academic, and it's not the case. It was actually, "We are the 99% was a slogan that Right to the City and an ad hoc group called Occupy the Capitol invented in the spring of 2011.
That was in D.C.?
That was actually in Albany, New York.
In Albany?
That's right. And it was in protest of the budget cuts, the austerity agenda of the power players in Albany and in New York City, you know, who were trying to take a butcher's knife to the public sector and to public programs. You know, they said, "We are the 99%. We are not represented. We're going to take back the Capitol. We're going to occupy the Capitol." You know, that was just a one-day occupation, but it really set the stage for what was to come.
Yeah, I just remember even some people here at our station saying, well, something is going to be happening down on Wall Street. We have no idea what will happen on the particular day. So we're kind of waiting on the alleged day
right.
to see what would happen. And then it was kind of smallish, and then it certainly mushroomed. So it the did. 99% leaving, then the 1%. So clearly captured the imagination. In terms of your work, doing this book and telling your story, how did you go about that? I mean, you were an occupier, but you also visited other cities. You also visited other countries. Is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. I knew that I couldn't tell this story just by, you know, limiting it to one city or one occupation.
New York City.
New York City. Of course, the world is in New York City, but, you know, it's not the world. So mm-hmm. there was first the participant observation. I was an occupier myself, and was writing about it every day, taking photos, footage, you know, interviewing people on the ground while it was happening. I didn't know I was going to write the book.
So you were there with your laptop or hand notes?
Hand notes. Yeah, old school, you know, but
amazing.
but I had a sense that this was something that was going to endure and outlive the occupied square, and that this was going to be the beginning of something bigger. Than just Occupy or Wall Street, even. It was mm-hmm. going to be about all of the struggles that that found a point of convergence and a point of unity here, and so once I had that, you know, I was able to also record and to critically reflect on what was going on in my own analysis, but then also to interview 80 other people from. Eight different cities, including New York, Atlanta, Oakland, Chicago, Madrid, and Athens, and was really and Philadelphia, and was really able to see kind of what the contradictions were, as well as what the connections between people in different places who were facing, as they saw it, a common enemy and waging a common struggle.
Okay, we'll get into that. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are going to take a short break. When we return, we will continue our conversation with Michael A. Gould-Rutovsky, who is the author of a brand new book, The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. Welcome back. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and continuing our conversation with the author of the brand new book, The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement, Michael A. Gould-Rutovsky, himself an occupier, part of the millennial generation, so it is called, and was in Occupy in Zuccotti Square right out of the gate. So you visited Occupy, and said, before we talk about Occupy in places like Madrid and Spain, about Occupy within the United States, within the cities that you visited. I mean, there's New York, there's Chicago, Oakland, et cetera. Tell us, I know there was a common thread, right, throughout all of the Occupy sites. What, if anything, jumped out at you that differentiated one city's occupation from another?
So each city had a kind of different context, a different history to the movement there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think there is a tendency to kind of generalize. You know, I'm also a social scientist, so, you know, we like to generalize about things. And I think there were really concrete conditions in each city that, you know, people faced different challenges, people faced different responses from the power players in each of these cities. So, for example, in Chicago, they weren't allowed to have an occupation at all. They were kind of kept.
Forget about
exactly,
it.
Exactly,
right?
Forget about it, as we say in New York. You know, of course, in Oakland, the violence of the police was you know, even higher than it was in other places. Part because of the history of struggle there. So
the history of struggle and the founding place of the Black Panther Party, et cetera,
exactly.
Pretty militant city, Oakland.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you had a different history mm-hmm. and also a different reality that on the ground, you know, people had different processes. It wasn't always consensus. It wasn't always, you know, the hand signals and you know, they varied from place to place. But I think you know, some of the differences were really one of they were among the strengths of the movement, because it allowed people to organize around the specific conditions of their lives, but also to link those conditions to a bigger struggle, something that was bigger than just, you know, their city or their town. So I think that was one of the great strengths of the movement. And of course, as the repression ran its course, it also became one of the weaknesses.
Right. And then what about Occupy in Spain and Greece? I mean, we know there's such a high point of struggle. The rise of Podemos in Spain. Actually, also, there's a lot of stirrings going on in Belgium. Ireland, tens of thousands of people on the street opposing the kind of privatization, a tax on water. But you were in Spain and Greece. Tell us about your experience of Occupy there. And at the time, did you get a sense then that those movements will be, that we would be seeing a rapid rise of Podemos, anti-austerity movement in Spain, and also, of course, the movement in Greece in electoral politics and winning?
Right. I think at the time, we didn't know. You know, people didn't know. The people I interviewed from the movement of the squares, as they called it, were kind of they were disheartened and disenchanted with the political process for very good reasons. Right. They had been shut out of. The democratic process, you know, so-called democratic process, by the power of the Troika, as they say, and also by, you know, the two-party system in Spain. And in Greece, of course, there was a long history. In both of those countries, actually, there was a long history of political organizing and radical kind of political traditions that had been brutally repressed under the dictatorships in each of those countries. And so this was a moment of emergence, of reemergence for the left in Spain and Greece. And I think, you know, this is a new chapter in that history that we're seeing today. And the sense of Podemos, right, what it means, we can, the sense that we can, I think was a sense that people first got in the occupied squares in Puerta del Sol, you know, in Syntagma Square in Athens, and then translated that into electoral organizing as well as ongoing social solidarity movements that really made it possible for these parties to begin to take back some of that power.
Our guest is Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky, author of the book The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. Really important book. Michael himself participated in the Occupy movement and is of the generation, really, that in many ways took the lead in the Occupy movement. So now I wanted to ask you about this horizontal versus vertical organizing, because we hear a lot about this horizontal organizing. And what is the origins of it, and what, from what you could tell, was the working definition of horizontal versus vertical organizing? Still today, a lot of controversy around it.
There is, and there should be. I think it's an open question. So horizontalism, as I understand it, as an aspiration, is a process of decision making, a way of making decisions in which the aspiration is for everybody to participate and nobody to dominate. That is the aspiration.
No leaders.
This, I think, comes out of, there are long traditions of horizontal politics in Latin America that preceded this movement, but there, I think it's in part a false dichotomy, because you see a lot of horizontal spaces places where horizontal politics is being practiced, or they say horizontal politics is being practiced, where the power relations are very much still there, where there are still people who are dominating.
I was going to ask you, did you really see any leaderless occupies?
I didn't.
Neither did I.
there was a leadership, and it was an informal leadership, and there was also a kind of what a feminist author in the 70s called the tyranny of structurelessness, where, you know, there's a kind of process that doesn't have structure, but then that leads to some of the same people who would have dominated in any other kind of space, continuing to dominate the discussion, continuing to dominate those spaces. And I think that, you know, the Occupy moment really unfolded at the nexus between the horizontal and the vertical. And I talk about this in the book. And it was fraught with contradictions for that reason. And I think there was a...
Tell our listeners what you mean by vertical.
So by vertical...
The occupiers meant by vertical.
But what the occupiers meant by vertical was a sort of hierarchical structure. They often referred to political parties or trade unions as inherently vertical structures as opposed to the horizontal spaces that they saw themselves as creating. And I think, you know, there is something real to this aspiration to create truly democratic spaces in an undemocratic context. In a fundamentally unequal society. But I think that...
You mean like having freedom under capitalism?
Right. and you know, people tried to do that, but I think that the practice did not live up to the principle. As I saw it in the occupied squares, the relations between people were still power-laden. They were still... you know, kind of dictated by what people brought with them from the larger society. There was a sense that they were creating a little, you know, utopia in the shell of the old world. But I think that, you know, this was really, it was part of this society. And, you know, there were vertical organizations, as they put it, that really helped make the movement as well. It wouldn't have happened without the trade unions. It wouldn't have happened without community-based organizations with, you know, structures of leadership that they saw as you know, more traditional, more vertical. So I think the nexus between these was really the sweet spot, at least for the development of the movement, and it wouldn't have happened without those other players as well.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're having a discussion about the Occupy movement with the author of The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement, a young man based out of New York City, grew up in New York City, Michael A. Gould Rutowski, from a working class background. Dad died when he was a young age and raised mainly by a single mother, went on to become Harvard educated. That's quite a feat in and of itself, training in movements of high school students in New York and movements for justice while he was an undergraduate student, etc. So, Michael, on this issue of horizontal and vertical, I mean, it does seem to me as though people want a very clear idea of it's either this or it's that. It's very difficult, I find, to live under capitalism and really know what freedom and liberation is. We don't know. We are so encumbered. We ourselves are so part of it. Each day is such a struggle, in a way, against it, and to find one's voice, one's determination to remain clean and find one's own. So the idea that we would have the answer in the middle of that structure is very difficult. It's like democracy. A lot of Black people like myself, when America is this, we were like, what are you talking about? Okay. You know, look at the U.S. Constitution. Look at where, you know, so we're sort of work as Hugo Chavez, we're sort of working our way towards it. So maybe we're working our way towards a kind of collectivism that perhaps existed in some indigenous societies. There's a new book out on the Tanzania's socialist villages, Ujamaa, and Sojourner Truth, we are going to be hosting an event on that, right? Some of the collectivism that I saw among indigenous people traveling in Central and Latin America, where the whole village would gather to discuss a particular issue and come to some consensus. But that was a little bit different here. And it does seem as though, rather than this butting heads on one or the other, of really figuring out what's going to work, and that the ends doesn't justify the means, that the means is part of how you get to where we are. But isn't it a process that we're working out?
Absolutely. And I think this is, you know, there's also a saying, from Latin America, that the road is made by walking. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a sense that that people have in the movement, especially now, kind of reflecting on you know, the shortcomings and then the lessons learned, seeing that this is a part of a longer process and that this is going to be, you know, a long-term walk.
Not a weekend
freedom,
warrior.
Not a weekend warrior. Mm. That's right. And, you know, my people tells a story where, you know, we wandered 40 years in the desert before reaching the promised land. Of course, it's a story. But I think there's something to that. It takes a long struggle, you know, to get there.
Yeah. And that also goes to something I wanted to ask you about, because we're now getting into some of the weaknesses. We talked about the strengths of Occupy, the excitement of Occupy, the imagination that came along with Occupy, but also some of the inherent problems. I mean, there, which one had to do with autonomy of women, of people of color, because there were some of those voices in this horizontal structure that basically replicated some of the same power relations outside of Occupy and impoverished people, people of color, women. There were issues of sexual assault, certainly here.
Absolutely.
In Los Angeles. Occupy the Hood came about, people of color trying to, you know, find a space and some autonomy. And there were issues in there. Did you, what was that, some of that reflected in what you, well, I know it was because it is in your book.
It is.
But talk about that a bit.
Yeah, I think it's something that you can't talk about this movement without talking about it. You can't talk about it in a real way without talking about those issues. And this is something, another one of the reasons I wrote the book, I think, was to put those front and center. The fact was that, you know, Occupy was not a liberated, autonomous space. It was very much part of a capitalist and a racist and a sexist society. And I think you saw in the interpersonal relations, as well as in the institutions of the movement, the relationships between white people and people of color, the relationships between men, women, and you know, transgendered people, the relationships between in some cases you know, very wealthy people who were participating in this 99% movement and the 99% of the 99% movement, they were all defined by the inequalities that they were confronting elsewhere. And at the same time, there were groups that came about, that came up out of the Occupy moments, like from the Occupy Wall Street People of Color Working Group. And I interviewed people from that working group and from the Safer Spaces working group, from Occupy the Hood to Occupy El Barrio. There were groups that really took on these issues head on. And there's a story that one of my respondents tells about the first time that Occupy working group tried to meet in Zuccotti Park. And they said, "Occupy People of Color Working Group over here," and expecting a mic check. Mic check, mic check. Occupy People of Color Working Group, meet over here. Nobody would mic check it. Nobody would echo that call. So
wow.
I think that was really illustrative and an illuminating moment. And there were many moments like it where, you know, people who were silenced and marginalized in our society at large were silenced and marginalized within the movement as well. And that didn't stop them, of course. They're still organizing today.
Yeah, and also we are going to have to, I mean, there's a lot more that could be said about that, because the movement for change as a whole still grappling, you know, with the issues of autonomy, which is different from separatism. How do you do a kind of multiracial cross-sector organizing that still respects autonomy and individual voices in it? How not to sideline the reality of the lives of the very people that you say you are for,
right?
And without manipulating those people. So listen, these are ongoing questions of the movement that have gone on for quite some time. The other, I do want to talk about the post-Occupy period a bit, but also the kind of cross-generational, because in a way this is a kind of a cross-generational discussion. And sometimes it gets a bit aggravating when people talk about civil disobedience, for example, as though was invented in Occupy. I remember in Brownsville, the Brooklyn, the building of the Downstate Medical Center, there were, back in the days of the Civil Rights Movement, there were 700 black people who were arrested that summer blocking cement trucks and disrupting the building of that site for their refusal to hire black people. I mean, there were, so civil disobedience, you go, you know, John Brown, I mean, you know, go like way, way back,
all
not
way
to
back.
Mention people who have been imprisoned, people who have been killed, et cetera. So unfortunately, without that kind of cross-cultural dialogue, perhaps, or recognition of history, without one side talking down to the other, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can build from previous movements. We can move forward. So that was another issue I found in Occupy. And I know that there were times, certainly at Occupy LA, where there was an attempt to establish, you know, that kind of cross-generational dialogue and working relationship.
Absolutely. I think, you know, that there is a much longer history to this proud tradition of civil disobedience and nonviolent direct action. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we now recognize, you know, and that I read about in the book. But I think, you know, there wasn't a recognition of it that there needed to be at the time. And, and you know, people always think that they're inventing something new, that it's the first time this has ever happened in the history of the world. and as you know, as yeah. I know, as you know, as we all know now, I think that's people understand that's not the case.
And every generation has it. I, you know, saw Tom Hayden earlier, the generation, don't trust anybody over 30. Well, once you hit 30, what the heck are you going to do then? So it's amazing how the time flies. And I haven't even I had various things underlined and, you know, to raise with you about the book. I haven't even cracked that. But a bit about the post-Occupy period. Many of us know what happened. One of our staff members here was arrested when the brutal shutting down of Occupy Los Angeles. Many of us, I was part of women at Occupy LA. We were, you know, down there. I mean, people did what they could. Brutal crackdown in New York City as in other places. But Occupy continued. And not in that form, but in other forms. Tell us a bit about that.
That's right. I mean, once people were denied the right to assemble in public, really, you know, they,
in this
great democracy of ours, you know, people didn't just pack their sleeping bags and go home. They did go home, but they went home changed.
Those,
you know,
who could, who had a home.
Exactly,
to go to.
Exactly. There were many people who did not, who'd been part of the occupations, and that's also something I talk about in the book, what happened to them. But there's a larger arc to this movement. There's a larger trajectory, you know, I think hopefully there will be more books that do this. But I try to really follow the occupiers into exile to see where they went after, you know, after the evictions, after the tear gas had cleared. And what I found was a really vital kind of post-Occupy movement that went from, you know, working families and the fight for 15 that you're seeing today, to you know, the fight for a living wage, to the fight to keep families in their homes, occupier homes, successfully fought off foreclosures in 7 states, to efforts to really make healthcare universal for the 99%, to the efforts of students, you know, fighting for the education that is their right, for the right to higher education, and a lot of these Occupy offshoots are still alive and well today. And, you know, I think that to a degree, the repression worked its effects magically. And you know, there was some real fear and some real terror that people felt, I think, once they saw the full force of the state mobilized against nonviolent resistors. But I think that, you know, people took that and they did something with it. And you know, they're still doing something with it today.
Yeah, you know, a friend and colleague of mine, Selma James, she's based in London, England, tells a story of being out on a march, and there was a huge banner that said, "All power to the 99%. I love that story, and I love that sign and message, because it does tell us so much. Just finally, Occupy, a moment, a flash in the pan, a movement. Did Occupy change the world?
So Occupy didn't change the world, but social movements do change the world. It just takes time. And I think that, you know, there was a kind of a moment where everybody woke up in 2011 and they didn't go back to sleep. You know, so I think that's a precondition for change. It's not what change looks like, but it's a precondition for change. We were told our entire lives, the millennials, we were told that there is no alternative. Right, this tyranny of no alternatives, as one of my mentors put it, and I think that tyranny has been overthrown. There's a sense that there are alternatives, that that change is possible, and that it's going to take a long haul, kind of struggle to get there.
So many people in the world now, when you say 99% or 1%. They're familiar with it. Then Mitt Romney came out with his famous 47%.
That's right.
You know, everybody in a way knew what he was talking about. And people who heard it in this country. But it does seem to me as though that is part of, you describe some of the victories of Occupy, but just that particular mindset, which brings some clarity, not full clarity, is also part of the legacy of Occupy, isn't it?
It sure is. And you know, that the return of class consciousness is something I talk about in the conclusion. The sense that, you know, that people share a struggle, and that struggle is defined by a fundamental relationship of power and inequality in society, and that that if they get together with people like them and people not like them, who share, you know, some of the same grievances and some of the same face some of the same injustices, they can really confront the power of the 1% and really you know, do something together collectively. And that sense of the collective, of collective identity, collective action, that sense of the collective is something really powerful that, you know, I think is going to continue to echo, reverberate, and resonate with people for many years to come.
Well, Michael A. Gould Wojtowski, we are out of time, I'm afraid, author of The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. And I have to say, it's been a hopeful discussion. I mean, for any of our listeners out there who doubt that there is a movement out there, who doubt that a baton has been passed from one generation to the next, certainly your work in this book and the work of your generation, and of course the generations after you, we know that indeed that struggle for justice will find a way of continuing. So thank you for coming in. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're out of time. I would like to thank our guest, Michael A. Gould Wojtowski. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team. Remember to like and friend us on Facebook if you are a Facebook member. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:58. Up next, we have Press Watch.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503 201-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee has been rescheduled to July 11th at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Radioland. I am Eldridge Cleaver, the former Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is listener-sponsored, non-commercial community radio. I want you to listen to and support KBOO because Portland needs it, you need it, and the world needs it. Ubalagani, boing, boing.
It's almost 9 o'clock Pacific, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is called Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know, left opinion, and counter propaganda. Have you been out to the Occupy ICE camp? Do you know where it's at? It's at the ICE dungeon, which has been fouling this town for many years now, and is at the intersection of Bancroft, Southwest Bancroft, and McAdam Streets, right by the freeway. And the Occupy ICE camp confronts what's going on there. And it's on a rail easement for a trolley that is now owned by TriMet. And it is a pretty well-organized camp, and it's a large camp. And it's a defiant camp, and it's a glorious, glorious thing. And you can go there and not get arrested because it's not ICE property. So there's nothing they can do in terms of kicking people off of that land on that basis. The ICE occupation has a KBOO booth because we're KBOO. That's what KBOO does. That's what community radio is for. We were there in 99 in Seattle. We were there at Occupy, and we're there now because this is a significant and historic